Welcome back to Coastal Connection. I'm Brian Russo. In this next segment, we're going to focus on the big, fragile body of water known as the Chesapeake Bay. Coming up in just a bit, we'll talk about a new report that tries to detail the impact and quantify the staggering amount of toxic pollution that is seeping into our nation's waterways from industry. First, though, we're going to talk with a man whose job it is to work with all the political heavy hitters involved in the cleanup of the Chesapeake Bay. His name is Nick DePasquale, and he runs the Chesapeake Bay Program, the regional partnership that has led the restoration of the bay since 1983. This week, he gathered together a group of governors, the mayor of D.C., and the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, or the EPA, to talk about the health of the bay. The group signed a new agreement recommitting themselves to protecting the Chesapeake and its many tributaries. Agreements, of course, are one thing, and finding the money and political will to take action is another issue entirely. So Nick DePasquale joins us now to talk about both the progress made this week and what it will actually mean for the bay, its ecosystem, and the people who live and work on the water. Nick, thanks for joining me here on Coastal Connection. Welcome.
Thanks for the invitation, Brian.
Let's talk a little bit about what this agreement earlier this week that was signed, what it does. I mean, obviously, there are already benchmarks in place to hit certain pollution reduction goals in the bay by 2025. What does this agreement do that's different?
You know, the bay restoration effort has evolved over time, and it began in 1983 with a one-page document between Virginia, Maryland, and then later Pennsylvania, agreeing that, recognizing that there was a pollution problem with respect to the Chesapeake Bay and committing themselves to work cooperatively together to find solutions to clean up that pollution. And, you know, it was a very simple commitment. There were a number of agreements that succeeded that were a little bit more detailed, a little bit more complicated. The big one was in 2000, we call it Chesapeake 2000, where there were about 102 goals, outcomes, commitments. And since that time, in 2009, there was also a federal executive order that was issued by the president, which basically directed federal agencies to step up their efforts their own efforts to clean up the bay and to work cooperatively with the states within the watershed. And then ultimately, there was the issuance of the total maximum daily load for the bay, which was a more regulatory initiative focused exclusively on water quality issues. And that was issued in 2010. So the Executive Council recognized, and that's the governors of the watershed states and EPA administrator and the chairman of the Chesapeake Bay Commission, you know, recognized that there were these kind of just three distinct efforts out there, and we really needed to do a better job coordinating them and integrating them. And really, the new agreement is designed to do that. The goal implementation teams, which really are the engine, the scientific engine of the partnership, took a good hard look at their goals and suggested refinements to them. We also developed outcomes that we like to refer to as SMART outcomes. They're specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound. We wanted to make sure that what we were proposing to do was something that we could realistically get done. We wanted to be able to measure it and measure our progress towards attaining that goal, and we wanted to set deadlines for doing that. The partnership agreements are authorized under Section 117 of the Clean Water Act, and they're voluntary agreements. They're not mandatory requirements. But when the signatories sign up to that agreement, they're essentially making a commitment to work towards those goals and outcomes. And probably the most significant feature of the new agreement is the establishment of management strategies that will articulate exactly how the goal implementation teams are going to go about achieving the outcomes. So there's going to be a written document. It's going to indicate what the targets are, who's going to be working towards achieving those targets, what kind of resources they're bringing to the table, how they're going to deal with things like impacts from climate change, how they're going to engage the public. This is a pretty comprehensive approach that improves the transparency and accountability associated with the voluntary agreement, the partnership itself. And I think it's been informed, obviously, by the work that's been done over the past 30 years, but it really is stepping up the game and providing a renewed focus on those things that we need to do to restore the health of a very large ecosystem, 64,000 square miles.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the comprehensive approach, but also all of the players are sort of involved as well now. This was the first time that the Bay's headwater states in New York, West Virginia, and Delaware have pledged to work towards restoration goals that extend beyond water quality.
Absolutely correct.
As you mentioned, you know, climate change and industrial pollution. What does this commitment mean, and how do you think it will affect the overall efforts to clean up the Bay and reaching those comprehensive goals?
Well, I think the inclusion of the headwater states, bringing them in as full partners in the partnership, dealing with issues beyond water quality like fisheries, sustainable fisheries, vital habitats, land conservation. You know, the environment doesn't exist in silos, independent silos, so you can take a look at water quality independently or habitat independently. These things are all interrelated, and this is really an ecosystem approach to environmental protection and restoration. And I think it is going to be establishing a precedent for how we may want to be conducting business in other restoration efforts and environmental protection efforts as well around the country and perhaps around the globe.
You know, you've worked on environmental issues in state government in both Delaware and Pennsylvania as well. I was reading, you know, some accounts of this week's agreement that was signed, and I found it really interesting. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett actually said that Pennsylvania was committed to doing its part and notice the importance of addressing pollution from agricultural runoff. You know, Pennsylvania has long been blamed, because so much of the water ends up in the Chesapeake Bay from upstate jurisdictions like Pennsylvania and New York. And
right.
Pennsylvania has long been accused of sort of slacking off on this issue. You know, you came out and said that this was an agreement that's really been years in the making. Give people a sense of just the legwork that goes into getting state governments and large political figureheads to just sit down at the table, let alone come to an agreement.
Yeah, I mean, you've really kind of hit the nail on the head. It's not an easy process, and there's, you know, an overlay. There's a political dynamic that exists that, yeah, obviously you have to deal with. I think the process that we used was one that really got people to the table, and we entered into genuine discussions about what the problems were and what we thought needed to be done. And there wasn't always agreement, you know, and sometimes we really had to work to achieve consensus. And the process took a lot longer than I think anyone had anticipated. Realistically speaking, there were some people who thought it couldn't even happen under the current political climate. And I was extremely pleased with the comments from Governor Corbett, recognizing Pennsylvania's very significant role, not only in the pollution, but recognizing his responsibility as the chief executive for helping to contribute to the restoration of the Chesapeake Bay. And, you know, at different times, under different administrations, there's kind of a waxing and waning of interest and enthusiasm for the restoration effort. Resources are tight, but I think the signatories to the new agreement really recognize that this is a very efficient structure, a very effective structure for moving forward with the next generation of restoration.
You know, the timing of this agreement is really interesting, too, because, you know, it comes in the midst of a legal battle over whether or not the EPA has the authority to dictate to states what they need to do to clean up the bay. A number of states that are getting involved are actually located very far from the Chesapeake Bay. And, some say it's becoming something of a test case for a larger debate about the balance of power between states and the federal government. You know, how does that legal effort complicate the work you're doing and the agreement that was reached this week?
Well, you know, it really didn't, interestingly enough. Hmm. I mean, coming out of the initial court case, Judge Rambo had made a decision that basically supported EPA's position across the board. You know, we were very encouraged by that. And I think, you know, for the signatories, this isn't just about the Chesapeake Bay. And that's a point we've been trying to make. And in fact, the new agreement is titled Chesapeake Bay Watershed Agreement. And with the inclusion of the headwater states, we now have everybody at the table. And I think they've recognized that while the bay is important for a whole variety of reasons, economic, ecological, political, they also have responsibility to their own local jurisdiction. So any effort that they undertake to make improvements to benefit the bay in fact, benefit these local communities.
We've been speaking with Nick DePasquale. He's the director of the Chesapeake Bay Program. Nick, always nice to talk to you, and thanks so much.
Pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
We continue our conversation about the environment with a new 72-page report that came out this week from the Environment America Research and Policy Center. The report focuses on toxic pollution by industry in this country, and it paints a pretty grim picture as it attempts to quantify the amount of toxic chemicals that are finding their way into our nation's waterways. As a result, the report calls for a substantial step up in what the Clean Water Act covers and how it's enforced. Joining me to talk about this report is Joanna Diamond. She's the Director of Environment Maryland. Joanna, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I can't say this report was light reading as I had my morning coffee today. And as I said in the opening, it does paint a pretty scary and grim picture. This report claims that 206 million pounds of toxic chemicals were released into America's waterways in 2012 in all 50 states and into 850 local watersheds. This report points to some of the country's largest industries and employers. First, let's start with the scope of the problem. How has this number grown so large?
So this report focuses on data from the federal government's toxic release inventory. So it only covers industrial facilities, meaning that, of course, many other sources of pollution going into our waterways, notably, for instance, factory farm pollution, are not covered. So they're fairly astounding, noting that it's just toxic water, toxic chemicals going into our waterways. And in Maryland alone, we're talking about over 1 million pounds of toxic chemicals into Maryland's rivers and streams.
As we look back over the years, just through, you know, sort of the 2000s, has that number grown substantially? And if so, why?
So on one hand, we've actually seen a slight decrease in the toxic discharges reported to the Toxic Release Inventory, or the TRI, which is where we're getting our numbers from. And on the other hand, we know that there are many polluting industries that don't even report to TRI, including factory farms. So the bottom line is this, though. With facilities that are dumping so much pollution, more than half of our waterways, approximately 59% of our waterways in Maryland, are still unsafe for swimming and fishing. And Maryland's waterways should be clean for swimming, drinking, supporting wildlife. And so we can take a big stride toward that goal today by restoring clean water protections for all of our waterways.
I'm glad you pointed that out. That brings up public health. You know, as I look north in neighboring Delaware, you know, as you mentioned here in Maryland, 53% or more than 50% of rivers and streams are too polluted for swimming, fishing, and drinking. You know, in Delaware, it's much more than that. It's almost over 90%. Let's talk about public health. What do we know about the immediate and long-term health impacts to our nation's population because of all this toxic pollution? And is there a way at this point to reverse it?
You know, the report shows about 1.3 million pounds of chemicals that are linked to, for instance, cancer. And that's going into more than 84 watersheds in 2012 alone. So we have chemicals that are linked to cancer. We have about 460,000 pounds of chemicals that are linked to developmental disorders, and about 4.4 million pounds of chemicals that are linked to reproductive disorders. So it has significant human health impact. You know, and the bottom line is this: the seminal clean water rule for the country was the Clean Water Act, enacted several decades ago, and so it was supposed to eliminate discharges of this toxic pollution by a certain date. And obviously, we haven't gotten there. You know, thanks to a lot of these big industries, they were able to get a couple Supreme Court decisions that got these loopholes in the Clean Water Act. So one of the ways that we can actually, you know, do something about this today is that the EPA gave us this opportunity. As noted as in some of the policy recommendations of our report, we want to make all of our waterways safe for swimming and drinking. And it's going to take a lot of steps. And in many cases, we can prevent this pollution right from the beginning by getting facilities, for instance, to switch from toxic chemicals to safer alternatives. But secondly, we need to start implementing the Clean Water Act the way it was intended, with strict enforcement and tough numeric limits for each type of toxic pollution. And third, we need to hold polluters accountable by requiring all toxic pollution to be reported to the Toxic Release Inventory. But of course, one step to curb this tide of toxic pollution stands squarely before us today, and that's finalizing the EPA's proposal to finally close these Clean Water Act holes.
Let's talk about the loopholes for a second, because, you know, we hear all the time about a law being in place and then loopholes sort of allowing things to happen that the law doesn't intend to happen because of aforementioned loopholes. Let's focus on Maryland. What are the loopholes in the Clean Water Act law sort of allowing to slip through the cracks as far as toxic pollution goes?
These loopholes essentially unprotected for the purposes of Clean Water Act protections. Many of these smaller rivers, lakes, wetlands, streams that are in Maryland, and the numbers are significant there as well. I mean, we're talking over 10,000 miles of streams that are potentially vulnerable to contamination because of these loopholes, and 17,000 miles of total waterways in Maryland. And like I said, I mean, those combined make up the drinking water for almost 4 million Marylanders. So this is throughout Maryland, sort of these smaller bodies of water are potentially impacted and vulnerable to contamination.
This study points out sort of a comprehensive nationwide, you know, statistical bit of data. Shows some of the most, you know, polluting states on down the line through the 50. It also points out and breaks down by region. Let's talk about the Chesapeake Bay and the Mid-Atlantic region. As I looked at it, you know, it was sort of color-coded, red being the most severe as far as the amount of pollution going into our waterways, and the Chesapeake Bay and the Mid-Atlantic region, and pretty much the entire East Coast, for that matter, was in beaming red. Talk a little bit about how our region and the East Coast matches up with pollution found in other regions, and can it be attributed to the fact that there's so much population in that area?
Sure. Well, yeah, you mentioned a great point. And in terms of our waterways right here in Maryland, Maryland ranks the 35th worst state in the nation for direct toxic discharges to our waterways. So it's very significant.
As I look at the report and it starts looking down some of the biggest polluters as far as industries go, agriculture and manufacturing were sort of the most prevalent on that list. So as we look at agriculture, how do we walk the line of meeting the demand of feeding our growing population and still ensure that we aren't doing irreversible damage to our environment?
You bring up a really good point. Agriculture pollution is one of the number one polluters to the Bay, and we simply are not going to meet our total maximum daily load without agriculture doing more. And in terms of what we're working on, agriculture pollution, which is not actually significantly included in this report because they are not reporting to TRI for the most part. And so in terms of what we're actually doing to provide food to our people, in terms of our health, in terms of our environment, in terms of the impact to our waterways, we shouldn't have the number one source of pollution to our iconic waterway, the Bay, not doing its fair share to actually clean up its pollution. We do not think that Marylanders should have to stand for that.
We've been speaking with Joanna Diamond. She's the Director of Environment Maryland. We've been talking about a new 72-page report that came out this week from the Environment America Research and Policy Center. You can actually read that report at our website, wamucoast.org. Joanna, thank you so much for joining me, and best of luck.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City and 88.5 in Washington. I'm Brian Russo. We'll be right back.